So let's go ahead and jump right into it. Why do chemical transformations occur? And well, let me stop and back up and say chemical transformations are occurring all the time, whether you're in an aerobic or an anaerobic environment. It's just that when you put water on things, oxygen is no longer available. And oxygen is fundamental in the process of chemical transformations, primarily being an electron acceptor and allowing biological processes to occur at the microbial level. All right? When you put water on there, it's reduced or eliminated, and that creates situations so that things can still function in an aquatic environment. You have other types of microbes that specialize, called anaerobic microbes, that specialize in transforming different types of chemicals, okay, organic chemicals. All right, so we've already talked in general that when we flood wetlands, you go from an oxidized state to a reduced state. So let's refresh our memory from Chem 101. What is oxidation? What is reduction? So, without looking at the notes, what is oxidation?
Is it adding electrons to it? Close.
It's the other one. Yeah. It's oxidation is that you lose an electron. Reduction is when you gain an electron. That's right. And the process of oxidation is fundamental to decomposition and breakdown of molecules. And other things pick up those electrons and transform that chemical into something else. So the breakdown of waste products, the breakdown of organic carbon, and other forms of other organic molecules. Okay? So oxidation is losing an electron, and it increases its valence in the process. That's less important, but reduction is when you gain an electron. And so there needs to be something out there to gain an electron in these chemical processes. And that is, for the most part, oxygen in aerobic environments. It's taking up electrons and allowing for chemical transformations to occur at very fast rates, actually. Okay. There is something that measures the tendency to go from an oxidized to a reduced state. The faster this happens, the faster the rate of these transformations. And again, one of those being decomposition. So the higher the redox potential, the higher those rates. It measures the tendency of flow of electrons between molecules. And you can actually measure that with meters, the redox potential, and it gives you an indication of that rate. And that can actually be used to figure out how reduced a soil is. And we'll have some numbers of different ranges of redox, actually I do it right here, of redox potential. In unflooded situations, the redox potential, this is just like a standard, this is in, it's in some type of volts, millivolts, I think. In millivolts, and in an unflooded situation, it's between 400 and 700, okay, at an aerobic level. So using that as our barometer of redox potential and comparing it to flooded soils, we can get an idea of how long things have been flooded. And in flooded, it usually ranges from, well, right at 400 down to negative 400. So if you have a really low redox potential, that soil has been flooded for a very, very long time. Okay. And I'll relate that here on the next slide to give you a feel of actually rebounding from redox potential once a flooded soil becomes exposed to the atmospheric oxygen. So as I already mentioned, oxygen is a common electron acceptor and fundamental in these chemical transformations. However, when we're dealing with an anaerobic system, it's no longer there, or it's very low. Usually there still is an oxidized, there's oxygen in the water, and depending on the situation, usually in a couple centimeters of the soil, top portions of the soil, is still oxidized, has some oxygen. And that's really fundamental because it allows for these chemical transformations, aerobic transformations to occur right here, basically. Yeah, here's the soil layer and this image here, for that, those chemical transformations still to occur. But as you get deeper into the soil, anaerobic processes have to take over. All right. Why doesn't, when you put water on something, why doesn't oxygen just, why isn't it present all the way through the water and through the soil and into the soil and remain there? Well, it's used up very quickly, and the diffusion of oxygen from, in comparison to the atmosphere, in comparison to water, is 10,000 times less. All right, so it acts as a physical barrier of oxygen penetrating down to the soil. Why you can't breathe very well in water. One of the reasons. Okay? Good? So it's like a blanket. All right, so we have this, again, this zone that still does remain a little bit anaerobic, right, at the top soil portion of the soil layer, then it drops down into anaerobic. And this is where these other processes are going on. For this to happen, it can happen pretty quickly. It kind of depends whether or not the soil has been saturated much before. Depends on a lot of things. I may have them here. That the thickness of the aerobic layer, which is kind of related to these two, depends on the rate of oxygen transfer that you have down here, which can be influenced by really the quality of the water and the amount of wind action that occurs in this water column, because as waves, etc., are formed, they do physically capture oxygen and tumble it down into the into the water column, which creates a highly oxygenated system. And you would anticipate, you would predict that thickness layer, that oxidized layer, would be much greater when you're in those types of systems, which aren't the most common for wetland systems. Okay. The thickness also depends on microbe abundance and algal production, which works both ways. Algae will respond very positively to nutrients, which we'll talk about a little bit later, specifically nitrogen. And they can positively influence dissolved oxygen within a system. However, they, at night, plants respire and don't produce oxygen. They're producing carbon dioxide. And organisms, the whole trophic structure that builds around algal communities, are always consuming oxygen. So you can have very low levels, sharp declines in oxygen levels through a diurnal cycle. And oxygen levels in aquatic systems are always the lowest right before sunrise. You've had all night for the oxygen to be completed. So if you're doing any type of bioassessment stuff from an aquatic standpoint, you want to get out there before sunlight and measure the dissolved oxygen. I was in Puerto Rico doing some stuff. I'd start my water quality sample at 3 a.m. so that when the sun came up at 6, I was done. All right. Any questions with that, y'all? Pretty simple, straightforward. All right. So oxygen depletion. Oxygen is electron acceptor. An electron acceptor is required for biochemical processes associated with the breakdown of these three things are the primary things that are going on. And in the environment, we have breakdown of organic carbon, nitrogenous waste, which is being produced, and you have respiration, which is going on, that produces, for example, carbon dioxide, etc. And there are other chemicals that just exist in organic forms that are always there to be transformed and being taken up by plants that are vital for and animals and vital for survival. But these are three main biological events that are occurring, and there needs to be something out there to allow chemical transformations to occur for metabolic pathways to exist. And in order for this to happen, in an anaerobic environment, you have to have things that don't depend on oxygen, which are various types of anaerobic microbes. So microbial populations are mediating nearly all the chemical transformations in wetlands that have water, that are, when they're flooded, to accomplish all the those three activities on the left. So it's these microbes, which it's true in aerobic situations too. It's just that they're more efficient at processing the chemicals than the aerobic microbes are. All right, so let's talk about how does redox potential change. I think I have some other figures a little bit later. That really shows redox potential declining with duration of flooding. This is a little bit on the flip side of things. This is the amount of oxygen on the y-axis. Amount of oxygen in the soil, okay, on the y-axis. And the x-axis, it's days of waterlogged soil over a 14-day period down to a depth of 28 centimeters that it was permitted to dry. So things were flooded and then basically dried. And they looked at redox potential over time and related that to oxygen level. And as you can see here, there's a direct positive linear correlation between the redox potential and the oxygen content. And that just again goes back to the whole process that oxygen really is a great acceptor of electrons, and it can occur at a very fast rate. Okay? So you have those chemical transformations occurring much faster. All right, so redox potential decreases with soil flooding, and the potential for oxygen transfer decreases with flooding. Good? Pretty clear, straightforward, right? Good stuff. And why? Well, we've already talked about why. Why does this happen? We just talked about it because of that affinity of oxygen, again, being a good electron acceptor, because of its molecular structure, by the way. All right. Won't delve into going up and writing different graphs of oxygen molecules and various molecules. Those are horrid memories of the past, probably for most of us. Okay. Now, are all chemicals, just like oxygen is a great electron acceptor, other chemicals that are in the environment that can be an electron acceptor do not have the same redox potential. Okay, they do not. Their molecular structure is in such a way that certain chemicals are first used up, then followed by other chemicals. So let's talk about that. Again, we already mentioned oxygen here for the 100th time, being the first one. And when during the very commonly oxygen, the byproduct of when it is used to accept electrons, the byproduct is water, but that's not that important. It'll be important when I put the rest of this stuff up here. So the order of basically elements that are very common in the environment that can function as an electron acceptor go in the following order: nitrogen, manganese, iron, sulfur, carbon. That, knowing that order is important, y'all. Okay, so basically oxygen number one, nitrogen, manganese, iron, sulfur, carbon. And we're going to go through each of those in pretty good detail, but make sure you understand and you know that order. Okay. And here we go. Here's our approximate redox potential for transformation. So again, down to, we're using oxygen really around a 400 millivolts, and then around 250 as the redox potential is going down, down, down. Nitrogen is being used, and then manganese, and then once you go from 100 to negative 100, iron, negative 100 at negative 200, sulfur, and below 200, carbon is the only thing that's actually accepting electrons at that point, for the most part. Okay, unless there's inputs of these other elements. So if you measure the redox potential, again, you can really get a good feeling for flooding and duration of flooding. For this to happen, it takes about 2 weeks to get to this stage of constant flooding. And then things are moving really slow. That's with no inputs. That's like a stagnant type system. Mm-hmm. That's right. So if you get a flux of nitrogen in there, then you certainly would see the processes of nitrogen accepting electrons, which we'll go through in just a second. Ammonification and nitrification, denitrification. Okay, so just in general, what I want you to kind of see here is this outlines the chemical transformations. We're going from the oxidized form, the most common oxidized form, we'll talk about this in more detail next slide, for nitrogen is nitrate, and then it can be broken down into ammonium, nitrogen gas, or nitrogen gas will combine with oxygen and be nitrous oxide. For magnesium, you have what's called a manganic form of manganese, and then it is reduced down to the manganous form. For iron, okay, and that's what you're seeing down here. Notice here, though, I want to make a point here, is that when these chemical transformations happen and you go to the reduced state, including oxygen, you always have water as a byproduct. That's an important thing to just observe. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, I did. I am missing that, aren't I? Yep, good observation. Okay, we have ferric hydroxide that is in the oxidized form, and then we have ferrous iron in the reduced form. And then you can have a variety of oxidized sulfur molecules. Sulfate is one of the most common, and then it produces some type of sulfide, commonly, which we'll see is hydrogen sulfide being the byproduct. And then finally, carbon dioxide being reduced forms methane, and we'll talk about that in more detail. So it's kind of just an overview of really the oxidized and the reduced forms, and you should commit to memory these names. And we're going to talk about those, though, in more detail here in just a second. And again, notice water is always a byproduct. Okay. Any questions there? All right. So, what am I interested in having you guys remember, right? Well, that's always a kind of a good question. This is a great graph right here that summarizes really what we've talked about in the previous three graphs. I really like this graph, and it's a very easy question for me to ask. And that is basically describe the relationship between the relative concentrations of oxidized and reduced chemicals that we've discussed about their importance in the chemical transformations in wetlands, and talk about their relative concentration over time as the duration of flooding increases. And this figure summarizes it all. It's a great figure. All right, so let's kind of walk through each of these. And what we have here is the solid lines represent the oxidized form, and the dotted lines represent the reduced form. So here we go. We have oxygen that after just a couple days of flooding, it's usually gone, except for that really narrow layer at the water-soil interface. It's depleted. As soon as it really becomes depleted, then if there's any nitrate that's in the water, it becomes the electron acceptor for these chemical transformations. And it is reduced over time, and we'll talk about what it is reduced into. It's reduced into ammonium and nitrite, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. Yeah, there's ammonium right here. Yeah, never mind. So now you can see as nitrate's decreasing, you can see the ammonium ion, is increasing in concentration. Right, not far after nitrate is completely depleted, but you have manganese, which has a pretty similar attractiveness for being an electron acceptor. And it starts to become depleted, and you start to see, I think I have this in here, ammonium. Yeah, going from the manganic form, then you start to see the manganous form increasing in concentration. Where is it? Oh, it's right here. Right here. Okay. All right. And then again, going from ferric hydroxide molecule in the oxidized form, then you see ferrous iron increasing over time, the reduced form. And again, your sulfates here being high, then decreasing, and then you have an increase in a reduced form, such as hydrogen sulfide. And then way out here, you have CO2 actually, which is a byproduct of several of these processes, and then CO2 starts to become an electron acceptor at that point. And then CO2 produces methane. And you're really darn reduced once methane is being produced. Okay? I think I had some, yeah. Well, yeah, I just had a note at the bottom. Notice the sequence of concentration of the reduced forms. So, again, we're going from oxygen accepting electrons to nitrate and manganese, to iron, to sulfate, to carbon. All right. Good? All right. Changes in acidity. This is another phenomenon that we see in wetlands, is there's when a wetland is flooded, if it's a mineral soil, usually mineral soils are very alkaline. They're at least on the alkaline side of pH. And they will decrease in pH over time when they're flooded. On the flip side of things, organic hydric soils tend to be higher in pH, or lower in pH, excuse me, and they become more basic over time. And this is graph summarizes this process. And it's related to the amount of iron that's also in the soil. So if you have high organic matter and high iron, then you have high organic matter and very, very high iron. And this is duration, that's pH on the y-axis, and time after submergence on the x-axis. And usually, again, low pH of organic soils, around 3, less than 4 usually. And as they're flooded, you see this very quick increase in pH, especially if they're high in iron. And, well, we'll talk about why that happens. Simultaneously, for mineral soils, you're up in the alkaline region usually, and you see a decrease. The process, this process is happening when you have low organic matter. It's the process in which you have CO2 production, and that combines with water to create H2CO2, which is, what is that chemical? You had it most recently, man. It's carbonic acid, so it's making more acidic. Yeah, so this is carbonic acid, and consequently a reduction in pH. The process of reducing the ferric iron hydroxides that are the oxidized form, right? Ferric iron hydroxides are the oxidized form. The process of reducing it ends up increasing pH for these guys. Oops, sorry. Okay. So those are the two reasons, for the two processes.
So for those lower lines, is it going to be the reverse? Is it going to go from carbonic acid to CO2 and water?
What is that again?
Would it go in reverse from carbonic acid, since you're more acidic, to
from here? This is the pathway from here, or from the bottom?
Okay, like the bottom right. Line, mm-hmm. If you have a higher acidity, like say carbonic acid, would it go backwards to like a bicarbonate solution?
It could. Yeah, I guess it could. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Other questions? Okay. So let's go through each of these different pathways. So nitrogen, as I mentioned, after oxygen, is the first chemical that is an electron acceptor. And this very organized graph summarizes all the processes. So, you can just kind of commit this thing to memory and you'll be good to go. So what we're talking about, again, is the oxidation of organic nitrogen. And so what we have are different processes in which that happens. So you have organic nitrogen, which becomes soluble in organic nitrogen, which is often in the form of urea. And then from that point, soluble organic nitrogen can combine with water through a process called ammonification, and it produces, well, some CO2 and ammonia, and water as a byproduct. Okay? So we can go from soluble nitrogen, urea, down to ammonia. Ammonia is highly toxic to aquatic organisms. But fortunately, it doesn't stay in the environment very long. But if there are continual inputs of nitrogen, urea, for example, cattle defecating in a water source, or nitrogen runoff, you could have issues with this. This, again, is very toxic. It takes very low levels for it to kill an animal. All right. Levels around the range of, for example, for amphibians, around the range of 0.6 milligrams per liter are toxic, which is not a whole lot. In contrast, when we get to the end, well, I'll leave you all in suspense there. All right, we'll talk about the other forms of nitrogen. So ammonia can, once we're at that stage, it basically can volatilize and go directly into the environment. And or it can combine with water and form ammonium. Okay, well, that should be a plus. Oh, it is a plus. I couldn't see it. Ammonium is the most common form of nitrogen that's out there in flooded soils. And ammonium itself, and here's just kind of going down both of these pathways here. Ammonium can have several fates. Ammonium itself can be taken up directly by plants. So it stays within this cycle. So you can have organic nitrogen being cycled right back into plants. And that form, although it kind of shows it coming from the plants here, that could be, again, animal waste, etc., that is in the form of nitrogen. And it's being taken up and incorporated within the plants. It's important because not only that, but for other reasons, well, I'll just hold off on that thought. So we have that. It can be taken back up into plants. Now, what else can happen? Ammonium can be taken up by algae that's in the water, so just aquatic plants. And then it can also go through another transformation process called nitrification. And nitrification is a process in which ammonium is interacts with oxygen. And so we need to be in this oxidized layer of the soil or up in the water column for nitrification. All right, that's important. Everybody write that down? Obviously, you can see the oxygen there, so if you're in the anaerobic zone, you're not in a good place. So ammonium combines with oxygen, and it is converted to nitrite. Nitrite is right here, and so write down the names of these. It's kind of important. Ammonium, nitrite, can be taken up, again, by plants. Nitrite is not as toxic as ammonium. A comparison, again, just to use tadpoles, something that I'm familiar with, it is around 2 milligrams per liter that is toxic for nitrite, 0.6 milligrams per liter for ammonia. All right. If we're again in this oxidized region here, then it can pick up some more oxygen and become nitrate, which is very, very common in the environment as well, in this oxidized region, in the aquatic system. Okay? Nitrate, it takes around 20 to 30 milligrams per liter for it to be toxic to tadpoles. So the toxicity goes down really exponentially from ammonia. So ammonia could be considered not that important of a thing in aquatic systems, biological processes, because it usually rapidly changes pretty quickly, both here in the anaerobic zone and in the aerobic zone, to ammonium. However, if you have continual inputs of organic nitrogen, it's going to cause problems. And that's often a consequence of anthropogenic factors, again, such as fertilizer or allowing cattle to go down into aquatic systems. Okay. Our farm ponds that we measured in West Tennessee were on the order, continuously over 6 months, on the order of, well, on average, around 0.8 milligrams per liter. which is at a range that can be toxic. Okay. So, yes, ma'am. Yeah, with cows going in. The ones without were around 0.3 milligrams. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Now what? So now we have nitrate, which is NO3. Okay. Nitrate. And you can have there can be a downward diffusion, and then we can go through another process here, which we'll talk about. But you can also, with nitrates, very soluble, you can lose it, it can go to runoff, it can be leached from the soils, or it can go through the process called, the next process of denitrification. All right. Denitrification occurs within the aerobic zone. Anaerobic zone. Occurs within the anaerobic zone. And what is C6H12O6? Yeah. So it combines with sugar through denitrifying bacteria, and it is then converted into CO2 as a byproduct, water, and then it produces nitrogen gas, which can combine and create, often combines, as it often will rise up to the surface with oxygen and create nitrogen nitrous oxide. Okay, so this is kind of the end, ultimately, of the pathways. Again, it could be ammonium, can be taken back up, or it can go through this process where ultimately, ammonium or nitrite can be taken up by plants. Nitrate can be washed off, or it can become, it can enter the denitrification cycle. And then from there, then you're dealing with a gas that is released into the environment. Okay? Now that CO2 is important because that's going to come into play in the carbon cycle. That's not the only CO2 CO2 that's in the water, but that is a byproduct. Denitrification produces CO2, which can be used in the carbon cycle. What else we got going on here? Atmospheric, simultaneously, you can have atmospheric nitrogen that can, and wetlands can act as a sink for atmospheric nitrogen. The other thing here that you can see, and I'm kind of coming back to the comment that I made earlier about this process of being uptaken by plants, ammonium and nitrite. Also, algae, the same cyanobacteria, the blue-green algae, take up nitrogen. This whole process keeps nitrogen within a system, and it just keeps cycling it. So you can have, stuff being flowed in, and basically you're creating organic biomass here. And you can even, atmospheric nitrogen can come in. So the whole point of all this hand-waving is that wetlands are great nitrogen sinks. And although it can be, excessive nitrogen can be toxic to aquatic organisms, they're great for filtering chemicals. One of the benefits of values of wetlands is them processing water that's of poor quality, high in various types of chemicals, and nitrogen's one of those where it can convert that and transform the nitrogen into plant biomass. Okay? Pretty clear? Pretty simple? Straightforward? All right. Now, really gets easier after this one. The second and third electron acceptors are, what do you guys, where are they?
Yeah.
I and P. Oh, important. IMP, important. Yeah. Oh, that's one other thing as I'm sitting here looking. This high pH, this volatilization of ammonia only occurs when the pH is high. I guess that was the only other thing that's on the slide that I don't think we've talked about. Questions. Okay, second and third electron acceptors. Okay, so we're dealing with manganese and what else?
Iron.
Iron, right. So manganese, again, we're going from the manganic form to the manganese form. And that's about all I have on that, which we've already talked about. And then you have iron, which again, you have ferric, a ferric hydroxide. And it is the reduced form. This occurs through a chemosynthetic bacteria, Theobacillus, whatever the scientific name is, ferrooxidans. And anyway, so then you have reduced iron. And this is a soluble form. The reduction of iron is, that process there, is the field indicator that shows you glaying. All right, so when you see those gray streakings or a gray tint to the soil, it's because of reduced iron. Yikes. Okay, thank you. It's because of reduced iron. So that is, again, one of the indicators, and by the time you have reduced iron, you're usually into about, you know, 5 to 7 days of flooding. Okay? It does depend on that characteristic. You do have to have iron in your soil. So if you're in a region that has very iron depauperate soils, then you're probably, that wouldn't be a good field indicator. That's true with all these chemicals. Doesn't mean that all these processes are going to go on in a particular wetland. They have to have the, it's just the order if they were all present. And there are certainly cases where some wetlands are more limiting than others with respect to those different molecules. Okay, now, if ferrous iron comes in contact with oxygen, it is transformed into some type of iron oxide, and there's several different forms of iron oxide. FeO is one of those forms, but iron oxide creates rust. One of the chemical, the only chemical of rust? Anyways, creates a rust. Now, we talked about this previously when we talked about field indicators. The oxidized rhizosphere that can be seen in reduced zones of around plant roots is a field indicator, and this is why, because what happens is reduced ferrous iron comes in contact in this reduced zone with oxygen that is leaching out, diffusing out into this reduced zone, and it can result in iron oxide being formed, which really can literally encapsulate those roots in an iron oxide barrier. And that can be a barrier for other nutrient uptake, which can result in death of the plant, mortality of the plant, or at least die off of the roots and potentially death of the entire plant. So wetland plants are very good at this oxygen regulation of definitely getting oxygen down to your roots, but not too much. And if they do too much, then that can be that can negatively influence them, obviously. So, very obligate wetland plants do this, and they do not allow very much leakage of oxygen into the anaerobic zone. All right, any questions? Okay, so on to sulfur, which is the fourth electron acceptor. Another very simple graph. It's got it all laid out right here for you. Pretty basic. Okay, so we have organic sulfur. As I mentioned before, organic, the oxidized forms of sulfur, there are several different forms. Common form is sulfate. But there's four forms, common forms listed there. And this is one of those situations, one of those chemicals where I mentioned that there's a good example that depends on the type of wetland you're in. Estuarine wetlands have about 270 times the amount of sulfur than freshwater wetlands. And so the sulfur cycle is a very important cycle in chemical transformations, sulfur being an electron acceptor for chemical transformations in estuarine wetlands, much more than freshwater wetlands. That's an important note to make. Okay? So estuarine wetlands, the sulfur cycle in estuarine wetlands is more important than freshwater wetlands. More important component. Okay. So, just using sulfate as an example, as a form of organic sulfur, combines with hydrogen and forms hydrogen sulfide. And from hydrogen sulfide, it can go two different directions. That transformation can occur in the aerobic zone or in the anaerobic zone. If it's in the aerobic zone, often it migrates upward into the water column and it is released as hydrogen sulfide gas. And then some bacteria can use hydrogen sulfide to convert it into organic matter. There are other pathways, though, too, that can occur. So there's the hydrogen the sulfate emission, and that's the rotten egg smell that is also an indicator. It's right here. You know you're dealing usually with it. Well, it's indicative of flooded soil conditions. Even though you can have reduction of organic sulfur into hydrogen sulfide in the aerobic zone, in the oxidized zone. Okay, but if you step into a soil and you get that kind of swamp gas, not swamp gas, but that rotten egg smell, swamp gas is used to describe methane, then you know you're dealing with a reduced system, a very reduced system. Remember, this is the fourth electron acceptor. Okay, what are some other pathways? Well, sulfate can do a lot of different things, or hydrogen sulfide. Do a lot of different things. Sulfate itself can often becomes bound to soil, to clay particles. It can be leached from the environment. Sulfate also can be, if you have a lot of iron in your soil, it can combine with iron to create whatever FES is. And FeS2 is pyrite, and I don't know, iron sulfate, or what iron sulfide it would be. That's what it could be called, but forgetting the name, but I think there's another name for it. So it can combine with iron. Again, it can combine with clay. It can be leached. It can, as we already talked about, it can convert into hydrogen sulfide. So 1, 2, 3, I guess that's 1, 2, 3, that's 4 fates of it. And it could actually just be soluble and run off as well. So So, what else do I have on this slide?
Can you turn into sulfuric acid?
Yeah. What does it need? Hydrogen?
Well, I mean, right down there at the bottom.
Yeah, you keep going with that. Yeah, sulfuric acid, yeah. You'd have to have some hydrogen. What would combine with what, Nathan?
Well, you get H2SO4, and you have two hydrogen left over. You have to add another oxygen and a hydrogen.
Yeah, oxygen and a hydrogen.
Yeah, and then it makes...
So another hydroxide, or...?
Yeah, I think another hydroxide, you got sulfuric acid.
More. Yeah, so I guess that can happen, too. And that is a point. I don't know if I, yeah, some negative influence is a sulfur, there we go, sulfur reduction, our toxicity of free sulfides, and actually even production of sulfuric acid. Reduce availability of sulfur for plant growth. Again, uptake of sulfate itself, I think, can be taken. And then sulfur will combine with other important minerals that are taken up by plants, such as zinc and copper. So it can make it bind with those and make it unusable.
Mm-hmm. This is nitpicky, but is it absorbed or adsorbed?
Well, it says absorbed.
AB.
AB.
It is AB.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay. Absorbed. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I am going with Mitch and Gosselink and assuming that they got their words right. Yeah. That's true. Add. Yeah. AB?
Yeah.
So it is correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Absorbed. All right. Good points, actually. Good point. Okay. Any other questions? Bringing everything together, aren't you? That's good. Using your soils knowledge. Good. Good. All right. We're almost done. The carbon cycle, the carbon transformations that occur in wetlands. Soil's got to be flooded for a long time. So you have two processes that occur here, and it starts with a particulate organic matter or a form of particular organic matter, dissolved organic matter, which is usually in the form of like ethanol. And fermentation is the first process, which uses organic matter as an electron acceptor during anaerobic respiration by microbes and it produces ethanol or CO2. Okay, so that's fermentation. You have these anaerobic bacteria that are using carbon or organic carbon and converting it to ethanol or CO2. And then methanogenesis is the use of CO2 as an electron acceptor. So again, CO2, it can be a byproduct of which cycle? Yeah, the denitrification. Yeah, denitrification, the very last end of denitrification, plus you have CO being obviously in the environment just from organisms respiring, etc. So it uses CO2 as an electron acceptor, and it produces methane. Okay, so once you have CO2, again, that can be converted to methane, and it also can be diffused and leave the system. Let's see, I guess in this process here, you can also have formation of carbonic acid. I don't know if I have that anywhere, but I guess you can. All right, so yeah, fermentation producing CO2, denitrification producing CO2, You have CO2 as a respiratory byproduct. These things are all kind of coming together. And then methanogenesis follows with that and can use that CO2 and it produces methane. And that CO2 apparently can combine with some water and create carbonic acid. All right. Good. So about 3 or 4 fates there. Again, understanding those processes are the most important. Now, methane is called swamp gas, and as most of y'all know, it is a natural greenhouse. It is a greenhouse gas, and this is a natural production of greenhouse gas within wetlands. It is a very efficient greenhouse gas, and what I mean by efficient, it because of its molecular structure, it is very effective at deflecting solar radiation back into the atmosphere. And much more so than CO2, or in fact, it is the most efficient greenhouse gas compared to all the other emissions, all the other gases that molecules that exist out there. It reflects heat at 23 times the rate of CO2. Thank goodness there isn't. Atmospheric concentrations are relatively low compared to other greenhouse gases. It's around 9%. So what about CO4 production? CO4, CH4 production? Just kind of, you don't need to remember the number, certainly, which is in milligrams of carbon per meter squared per day. But for bogs, they're very high for bog systems. Bogs are northern boreal type forested wetlands, like your evergreen forested wetland, evergreen, needleleaf evergreen forest. There we go. Those systems are flooded all the time, nearly all the time. Or saturated, and so they're producing lots of methane, basically, and you know what? Tons of litter accumulation in bogs. That's the process of bog formation is all about peat formation, which is just things aren't decomposing. So decomposition rates are so slow here. Once you get to this final end, this last opportunity for breakdown of organic carbon. followed by marshes, and this is your freshwater emergent marshes, which often tend to be flooded for longer durations, followed by forested swamps, such as bald cypress swamps. This particular is referring to those, deep water swamps, and then followed by riparian wetlands, like our bottomland forest that we have, okay? Broadleaf deciduous forest. And that's just related to, again, relative permanence of water. You may never hit this in many wetlands. You may never have fermentation and methanogenesis going on in a wetland. It has to be flooded for, you know, 2 weeks plus. Okay? So let's just, any questions with that? Is that good? So as I mentioned before, methane accounts for 9% of the greenhouse gases in our atmosphere, but it does have 23 times the reflectance of CO2. As far as the amount of methane in our environment, 60% of it is anthropogenically produced, 40% is naturally produced. So we're certainly contributing to the amount of methane in our environment, but there are also these natural processes. And this pie chart here is an illustration of all the processes together where you have some natural things like wetlands and termites and this is cattle here, ruminants and other, well, other ruminants outside of just cattle, wildlife too, deer and elk, etc. Produce methane in their digestive tracts. Rice paddy fields is, here's some, I guess we're running into the anthropogenic. Here's a, yeah, the two different shades here. One is natural occurrences here. Termites, ocean water, fresh water, and then basically then the rest are anthropogenic. Yeah, I have gas production, coal, landfills, biomass burning, rice paddies, and ruminants. I guess the ruminants here are just the cattle. Must not be the wildlife that they're considering being an important factor. So I mentioned 40%, well, obviously there's 40% left, so, but 30% is associated with natural wetlands. Okay, so we have basically our wetlands, oceans, termites, and hydrates. So I guess that's about it. Termites, yeah. Yeah, that's amazes me, the methane production from termites. That's pretty high. So yeah, 11% of 40%. About 5% or so, yeah. Well, anyways. Okay, cool. So, is that good? And that's it. That's all we have for chemical transformations. And so, yeah, it was kind of a short lecture, but not too painful as far as a little revisit to Chemistry 101. As of today, we're shifting gears, or after today, we're shifting gears to management. So next, on Thursday, we're going over waterfowl identification and waterfowl wing identification and also slide identification. So it'll be a lab, basically a lab class. And then next Tuesday, I'll be gone. I have to be in D.C. and John will be lecturing on shorebird management and conservation. And then I'll come back and I guess I'll, oh no, then we're on break, aren't we? Fall break. So then I'll come back after that, after I go down and watch UT beat the Bulldogs over fall break in Starkville, my old alma mater, and come back and start talking about management. And we'll be dealing with management for the next several weeks. And then we'll get into conservation, those things, when we have a bunch of guest speakers coming in. All right, do you have a question?
How much of the IV will be in this?
How much?
Is it going to be a big chunk of it?
It'll be a lecture's worth.
Oh,
absolutely, yeah. You won't have a separate test. It'll be part of the class test, yeah. But the slides and stuff, of course, you'll be able to look over those. And there are different websites and whatnot, and you can just get on field guides and stuff. You can practice looking at waterfowl and stuff like that. They're pretty easy. The wings are a little more challenging, so we'll have slides of the wings, but we will also have, we have mounts. John's just finishing putting together some mounts that we got from Southern Illinois University. So we'll have those and we'll make those available in the headroom. We'll just leave them there and you can practice as much as you want or whenever you want. Okay, if you have the opportunity at 7 o'clock, Ducks Unlimited student chapter is having a meeting down in 160 Plant Biotech Building. And it won't last more than an hour. It should be pretty cool, pretty good. All right. Oh, and the other thing is, again, I apologize, I didn't have the test.